Whenever I heard the word gaikoku, I just immediately equated that with the US. And so when my parents pointed out where Singapore was on the map, I was like, I realized how narrow my worldview was. Once we moved to Singapore, I made friends from all different parts of the world, and we traveled a lot around Southeast Asia when we were in Singapore. And then, so my curiosity really, I think, began when I moved to Singapore and realized how much I don't know. And that's really been a through line even to now. So in my work, I really try to foster that curiosity and open-mindedness around four different perspectives to stay curious. So for these medical students I work with as well, that's the kind of spirit I try to foster.
Welcome to episode 76 of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Our guest today is the program director at VIA, an international education profit based in San Francisco. She develops programs that promote cross-cultural understanding between Asia and the United States. Her experiences living in Japan, Singapore, and the Philippines have shaped her commitment as an educator to highlight diverse perspectives, especially those that are less visible. She earned a doctorate in education from UC Davis, a master's degree from Harvard University, and a bachelor's degree in biology and environmental studies from Oberlin College. Outside of work, she enjoys making latte art, reading contemporary and historical fiction, and spending time with her husband and son. She attended ASIJ from 1997 to 2003. Welcome to the podcast, Lena.
Thank you so much for having me.
So off air, we were just talking about how you've been to ASIJ, which is, you know, obviously in Tokyo, but you've been to also other international schools like Singapore American, International School of Manila. So, you know, a true TCK / international school graduate. Yeah. And it very much connects to the work you do. So actually, and I always forget to do this. I know I just, you know, had a rather brief introduction of yourself. Maybe in your own words, can you just tell us what you're up to right now?
Sure, yeah. So at VIA, I work primarily with medical students, actually. I develop programs for them, introduce them to perspectives that they might not learn about in medical school. So I do not have a healthcare background myself, but I use healthcare and medical issues as a lens through which to explore social and cultural issues. So pre-pandemic, students used to come here, where I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, for 2 weeks to learn about healthcare in the US. But now with the pandemic, we've shifted to virtual programs. So I run virtual programs for medical students, mostly from Japan, but we also get students from other Asian countries occasionally.
And you were mentioning how, you know, in your bio that your background of being a TCK, of being, you know, an international school graduate, has very much been a major reason, you know, of you doing what you do now. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a bit in regards to sort of your journey from, you know, living in Singapore and Japan and how that in the Philippines and how that's contributed towards your learning as well as how you, you know, you chose your current profession?
You know, I remember when my parents first announced that we would be moving to Singapore, I immediately assumed for some reason that, so my world map when I was like 8 years old was very narrow. Whenever I heard the word gaikoku, I just immediately equated that with the US. And so when my parents pointed out where Singapore was on the map, I was like, I realized how narrow my worldview was. Once we moved to Singapore, I made friends from all different parts of the world, and we traveled a lot around Southeast Asia when we were in Singapore. And then, so my curiosity really, I think, began when I moved to Singapore and realized how much I don't know. And that's really been a through line even to now. So in my work, I really try to foster that curiosity and open-mindedness around four different perspectives to stay curious. So for these medical students I worked with as well, that's the kind of spirit I try to foster. And then something else as well, having grown up in different countries, I've learned to like adapt and be flexible. And so I try to model that. Like, it's hard to teach that in a 2-week program, but it is something I try to model as well for students and for participants, because that sort of mentality is really important in working with people who have different backgrounds, different values, different beliefs.
You have a very unique background before SAS. So you transferred to Singapore American in third grade. I don't mean to deviate from the sort of the topic at hand, but I have a lot of friends who are, you know, like, they're thinking maybe Shoakko, right? Elementary school, Japanese public school, grade 6, you know, secondary school, switch to international school. In your case, was it the academic switch from Japanese public school to a school like Singapore American? Was that a smooth transition? Like, was language not an issue?
It was, actually. Although I was born in the U.S., and so I have U.S. citizenship, like, my first real language was Japanese. And so when I moved to Singapore, I was placed in an ESL classroom for a year. So my first year, I was taking ESL classes. And then my second year, I was out of ESL. But I remember struggling still to keep up a little bit. But I think sometime during that second year, I found myself gradually adjusting and just kind of understanding everything that was going on. But, and then by my third year in Singapore, I felt like my English was getting better than my Japanese. So, but I think another transition actually that was startling to me in addition to the language was the shift from public to private. So I went to a public Japanese school. So I, you know, remember staying after school with my classmates, cleaning the classroom and serving each other lunch, like, and eating lunch in the classroom. But moving to a private school where there are janitors and, like, it was just shocking. So I remember that as well. So that was like cultural / institutional shift and shock for me.
Yeah. And just the difference of privilege, I imagine, of, you know, the type of demographic of students, you know, Singapore versus a regular public school in Japan.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
It's intriguing. And so currently, you know, when you say you focus on healthcare, I guess this is the cultural perspective of how to look at various culture and social through healthcare. Can you maybe specifically explain what would that exactly look like in regards to, you know, a 2-week program?
Sure. So pre-COVID, we, for example, took students to the Castro District of San Francisco, which is where, like, in some sense, like, gay rights movements began. And so there's a clinic that serves gay patients. And so I would take them there. And for many students, they've never seen a clinic like that. And so it kind of opens their minds about LGBTQ rights and issues. And so that's one example. Another is, you know, they spend 2 weeks in San Francisco. They see for themselves the number of people living on the streets, the number of homeless people. And that's, again, something that shocks many participants who are not necessarily aware of that. So we dig into health disparities. And I also have done workshops on humanizing homelessness. So not specifically a healthcare topic per se, but, you know, these students are going to be future healthcare professionals, and they, I believe that it's really important for them to demonstrate empathy and to see all patients, no matter what their backgrounds, as whole human beings with stories that are not immediately visible. So that's another example of how the intersection of health and social issues.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear about. I remember we had a guest who was a doctor not too long ago, and he was saying, you know, just how important that bedside manner can take you.
Yeah, yes.
Linguistically, culturally. And You, you know, so as I was saying in the beginning, you're a true TCK. And I think a common theme with a lot of TCKs is, you know, what is home? You know, what culture they see? And that's sort of your wheelhouse, right? So do you feel at a personal level, you know, you have this background of Japan, but you're also at an international school. And now you've been in the States for over a decade. Would that be correct?
Yeah, actually, like close to 18 years now. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I would say now, yeah, I've spent most of my life in the US now.
In that perspective, do you feel like growing up, especially in those, you know, those latter formative years, like late teens, early 20s, did you struggle much with, you know, your identity? Like, am I going to go back to Japan? Because, you know, you do have this Japanese roots, but at the same time, super international. What was that journey for you like?
That's a really great question. So in terms of like my identity and where I consider home, I think that's something I still work through. So I still, in some sense, like a lot of places I've lived in are home, like, or, but then also like where I am currently is home. So it's like very fluid. And so, you know, unlike someone like my husband who was born and raised in one place, I don't really have that. So in some sense, like, I feel like I don't have roots, but I feel like I can adapt. So I can make many places my home. And in terms of my identity as, you know, American and Japanese, it's interesting. I think until actually like a year ago or something, like I really never tapped into my Japanese identity in my professional life. So when I was in college, when I was getting my master's, and when I was doing my PhD, it was subconsciously there, but I never really brought it into my work, into my academic work. It was only actually when I came to VIA, and only really in the last year, that I realized that I should tap more into my Japanese identity. So I recently had a chance to do that, where I worked with the executive director of VIA to offer a 5-month long professional development program for a mid-sized Japanese company. And it was all done in Japanese. And it was my first time actually to run an educational program in Japanese. So the content, the curriculum, I was familiar teaching in English, but it's my first time really doing everything in Japanese and corresponding and communicating with the participants. And it was a really interesting but rewarding challenge. And I realized like that's, I really should own that more. I didn't really, never really thought about it as a strength in my, as a, or that it could be a strength in my work until I had this experience recently. So I think that was a really important realization that I want to carry through more deliberately going forward.
And you have a son now, and I think,
yeah,
what I find intriguing is how much, and I think we're almost like in the midst of this big experiment. And what I mean by that is like, there's just more people that are mixed race now / like families, and like, Everyone's kind of trying everything, right? And I don't even know what's to come, you know, like, because I've had on this podcast, for example, my friend who's half Swedish and half Thai. And so, you know, in their household, it's like there's Swedish, there's Thai, there's English. There might be a little bit of Japanese there too. But at the same time as you and I would know, it's really hard to master those third, fourth languages, you know, unless we're talking like Spanish and Italian, you know, where it's clear overlap when, you know, when the writing is different. So anyways, I guess my question is, when it comes to kids, are you raising your child in the States kind of like as an American, or is it kind of like as American with a lot of Japanese on the weekend? Is that something that comes up in your household conversation often?
That's another great question. My husband is American, but he, like, ethnically he's Chinese / Vietnamese, and so with he and his parents speak Cantonese actually. For example, my son currently, as we speak, is spending time with my in-laws, And so he's getting exposure to Cantonese there. At home, I try to speak to my son in Japanese, but you know, my husband and I communicate in English. And so, and for me, as having lived in the US for so long and not having that many opportunities to speak in Japanese outside of the, you know, the work opportunity I just mentioned earlier, it just, English comes faster. I think practically speaking, like my son gets more English exposure than Japanese. Every once in a while when I have free time, I think about what his language trajectory could be like. But right now, I feel like in some ways just survival mode, just kind of getting through the days. And so his name. So my son's name, his first name is Kaisei. So that's a Japanese name. And then his last name, and his middle name is Lawrence, and then his last name is Ma. And so his name kind of reflects his complex identity. So he's Japanese, then he's, you know, born in the US, and then Ma is a very typical like, Chinese last name. So I really want him as he grows up to like be proud of his identity, to really own, you know, each and all the different aspects of him. How I'm going to foster that, it's to be determined, but that's kind of the hope that we have in his name.
Yeah, that, you know, prior to this conversation, I wasn't aware about the Vietnamese Chinese element. So yeah, he's a really international child. I guess also, at the end of the day too, as it's, I'm sure with, you know, your friends and my friends, even with siblings, there's a big difference. So there is also that element, right? Sometimes kids just will grab by the horn and they'll say, hey, I really want to learn this language and really embrace it. And then sometimes they don't too. So
interesting
thing. It's like that with ASIJ too, right? They were always kids who were half who like were super Japanese, right? They watched the Japanese TV shows, they read in Japanese, and then you had the kids who were half who, you know, that just weren't that immersed in the culture, ironically, because we live there. But that's really interesting.
So
I want to shift the conversation to SAS ASIJ ISM. So off air, we're talking a bit about how, for those who aren't familiar, I mean, I'm not a fan of like ranking schools, et cetera, but more or less those three schools are sort of the more prominent. They'd be considered the most, or, you know, one of the more prominent schools in each of those countries, Singapore, Japan, and the Philippines. So three different schools, you know, three different styles of education. How did your experience compare with those three schools?
And it's an interesting question. I think, in a way, it's hard to compare because it was different ages, right? Like elementary school in Singapore, and then, but having said that, I'm sort of grateful that my first international experience was at SAS, just because it was shocking, but in a good way. Like I was like in my class, there was actually one other Japanese girl, but I actually never became friends with her. I ended up like befriending other students from other different countries. And just, I know that sort of like the food and holidays, it's like a surface level aspect of culture. But for me, having not had any exposure to that prior to coming to Singapore, that was really eye-opening. And Singapore is such a diverse country in itself, right? There's like four official languages and all, you know, all kinds of holidays celebrated, and the diversity is also reflected in the food, and I'm a big foodie, so it was just really eye-opening to spend time both in Singapore and SAS specifically. ASIJ allowed me to sort of tap into, again, more of my Japanese identity. Like I, even compared to now, like I feel like I was most equally fluent in English and Japanese when I was at ASIJ. And I think the curriculum was really structured in a way that benefited me. Like they, you know, I was able to take, in theory, like, you know, the Japanese classes for native speakers. And so I got practice, you know, writing papers in Japanese, and that was really valuable. And it like I owe whatever Japanese ability I have right now to the classes and the training that I got at ASIJ. And then at ISM, I think the thing that was really challenging was the timing. I always knew that there was a possibility that my family could move, you know, but I didn't expect it to be my last year of high school. You know, regardless of where you are, whatever high school, moving that time of year is tough. It's just like most people have a lot of friends. And so that was challenging. And also, it was my first time living in a so-called developing country, right? And I had a lot of assumptions about it. I only heard really bad things about the Philippines, for example. And when I moved there, I realized how biased and, you know, then my news sources were. So that was a really important and eye-opening time for me as well. And so that's more sort of not specifically ISM, but just the move itself to the Philippines is really impactful. ISM as a school itself, again, really diverse. It made me more humble, I guess. Like I had to adapt a lot, you know, and, you know, making new friends, like it sounds kind of trite, but it was challenging to make friends. But having gone through that experience actually made my transition to college really easy. And then I think one experience that really stands out at ISM was this one week where, as part of service learning, I spent time at, like, an hour outside of Manila, there was an orphanage for children with physical and mental disabilities. And again, I had never visited an institution like that before, nor a geographical area like that remote. So that was a really eye-opening experience for me as well, and made me realize, again, how little I know about what's going on in the world, and made me more curious and also wanting to seek out more stories that are not really in the mainstream. So that's also part of my work now and my mission, like sort of making visible perspectives that are less visible. And I think that my experience in the Philippines in particular really brought that to fore for me.
Yeah. I mean, you were earlier saying, you know, making friends is trivial, but I would agree with you that it's a big thing. I think when you're a senior, when you're 17, 18, that's right? So, yeah. You know, props to you for surviving that. You know, as a high school teacher myself, I can't imagine. And being new as a senior is just, that's tough. That's when everyone is celebrating almost, you know, the first 3 years, right? They're not in right. That new friendship mode, right? And, you know, while we're on the topic of international schools, ASIJ, so I'm beginning to see sort of a bigger picture of how, you know, your background has led towards where you are now, specifically mm-hmm. the ASIJ, you know, during your, was it 6 years there? Yes. Any notable memories, any notable stories, anything you'd like to share on this podcast? Teachers that maybe left an impact?
There are two teachers in particular that have made a real impact on me. One is Mr. Hoover. He was a social studies teacher, my eighth grade social studies teacher. And I didn't really appreciate it at the time, or couldn't really put it in words. But now that I'm an educator, I really appreciate it. Like his pedagogy and the way he organized the themes. There was a U.S. history class that he took that he taught, but instead of like the traditional chronological teaching, which is sort of more the AP U.S. history style, it was more thematic. And so I remember a lot more of what I learned in eighth grade U.S. history than I do from AP U.S. history. Even though it was like 3 years before. I remember like the first theme was like conflict and consensus. Like that was my first theme of like the first quarter or something. And it was just really refreshing. I hadn't been taught history that way. So it made me more interested in history. And then the other teacher was my ninth grade English teacher, Mr. Cole. From him, I really learned the importance of asking for help. So before then, I was always a studious, you know, student who was like, who did not want to ask for help because I didn't want to, you know, come off as not working hard enough, or, you know, like I felt stupid asking for help or asking questions. But I remember my very first assignment. Basically, we read Three Little Pigs, but it was like an exercise in reading the lines, reading between the lines, and reading beyond the lines. And we had to write a paragraph on each. So a very simple exercise. And I was like, okay, yeah. But then, like, I got back the essay, and it was like marked all over the place. And it was like, and he wrote, "Come see me," like 5 times. I was like shocked. I had never received that kind of feedback ever, right? So I was like, oh my God, what did I do? So I was really intimidated and scared, but I went to see him, and he sat me through, like, and just carefully explained everything, like from micro level, like syntax and diction, to like more bigger picture stuff in my writing. And I was like, I was intimidated, but it was after the fact, I was like, wow, he really took the time to explain all this to me. And so ever since that, like with every other essay or whatever, you know, writing assignment, I didn't hesitate to ask for help and to like really try to improve it. And so I owe a lot to Mr. Cole in like, in how I approach writing now. I love writing. And when I was in grad school, I was a writing consultant. So I think taught me 2 lessons, like asking for help and not being like ashamed about it, but seeing that as a way to grow. And then also just like falling in love with the process of writing, and like, it's okay if your first draft is bad, like it's supposed to be. And it's like, yeah, it can be a work in progress.
Mr. Hoover and Mr. Cole. Interesting. Yeah, because I don't ask this question to actually many people. But when I did a few times, yeah, Andrew Hoover came up. You're not the first one to say it. So,
oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He's been gone from probably about 10 years now. He's actually now head of school at American International School, Chennai.
That's right. Yeah.
Big loss for ASIJ when he left, but you know, it's still doing good things in India. So
exactly. Yeah.
Usually at the end here in the podcast, I like to ask the guests what is to come in the coming years, decades. I think since we're in COVID times, I'm going to keep it short and realistic. And because it's still January, what's coming up for this year, this calendar year?
Work-wise, it's kind of pending grant approval, but it's an opportunity again to tap into my Japanese side. So basically, we're proposing a program for high school students in Japan and the US to connect. And part of it will be online, and then part of it will be in person, if COVID allows. And they'll be exploring issues related to sustainability, sort of applying like growth mindset, and we're targeting actually high school female students in particular, so kind of like empowering girls in that sense. So that's hopefully coming up, again pending grant approval. Continuing to offer programs for medical students, hopefully in the summer maybe we can do it in person. I think the pandemic, I wasn't really sure when the pandemic first hit and we were like doing virtual programs, like how, you know, my immediate assumption was like, it can't compare with in-person programs. And in some ways it can't, but I have seen how even virtually people can connect from different backgrounds and stay connected afterwards. So I'm looking forward to more fostering more of those connections, whether in-person or virtually. And a personal note, I'm hoping that my parents can come out to the US to see my son. They haven't seen my son in person.
Oh, really?
Because my son was born, you know, like 3 months into the pandemic. And yeah, they just haven't had a chance to come. So hopefully that'll happen later this year.
Yeah. I hope they make it over. My brother had his second child too, like during pandemic, and
Okay.
My mom's done it. She done the flight, and then when you come back, yeah. Now it's, I think last time was 3 nights. Sometimes it's 6 nights at that hotel.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it was great having you on this podcast. We've had, I think, people from, you know, Singapore. I've had people from the ISM, but I think you're the first one to have gone to all three of those schools.
Okay.
And yeah, just hope we can get in touch again. At school, we're sort of the same industry, right? And we're both in education.
Yeah.
With the older people, I'm with the younger.
Right.
Schoolers, though. They're not that young. For K through 12.
yeah, right.
But yeah, thank you for being on, and hopefully we can have this conversation again sometime in the future.
Yes, thanks so much, Nick.